Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's a news buzz edition of the show where we host quick conversations on Iowa news of the week. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk about rising tuition costs of Iowa State schools with Press Citizen reporter Jeff Carice Carlson. And later this hour, I'll get to know Mary Campos. She's an Iowa woman who is being honored by the ACLU of Iowa for her contributions to civil liberties in the state over the years. But first, a look at a sexual harassment case ongoing at our Iowa State Capitol. In a press conference this week, Governor Kim Reynolds said that sexual harassment will not be tolerated in the Iowa Senate, where Republicans face a multi-million-dollar court judgment in a sexual harassment lawsuit. Last month, a jury awarded the plaintiff in the case, Kirsten Anderson, $2.2 million in damages, ruling that Senate Republican caucus and the state violated Iowa laws preventing workplace harassment, discrimination, and retaliation in its dealing with the complaints that Anderson brought forward. The Des Moines Register's court reporter, Grant Rogers, has been covering this story, and he joins me now. Hi, Grant.
Hi.
So take us back a little bit. Tell me about these accusations of sexual harassment. What sort of complaints did Kirsten Anderson file?
Well, the types of behavior that Kirsten Anderson said she witnessed after she started working for the caucus were sort of regular jokes about women's sex lives, racial jokes. She alleged that a coworker showed her a nude photo on his work computer. And in addition to that, there was some concerns that at least one sitting senator at the time, now former senator, had made inappropriate comments, talked about lobbyists, female lobbyists and their bodies in degrading ways. She described it, and the picture built throughout the trial was that there was sort of a boys' club culture where degrading comments about women and minorities were tolerated.
Mm-hmm. And the defendants in this case are the state of Iowa, the Iowa Senate, the Senate Republican Caucus, and Senate Republican Leader Bill Dix, along with staff members Eric Johansson and Ed Fehler. You know, a lot of the defendants are still working at the Capitol. What were their reactions to, the juries awarding the plaintiff in the case?
Certainly. Well, Senator Dix has long maintained, and the defense attorneys defending the state throughout the trial have maintained that Kirsten Anderson was fired in May of 2013 due to concerns about her work product. There was documentation that for several months before her firing, people had spoken to her about the quality of her writing, and there were concerns about that. And following the verdict, Senator Dix reaffirmed his belief that it was her poor work product that was ultimately the reason that she got fired. At the same time, an investigation overseen by the state has started, and Senator Dix has been clear that he has a zero-tolerance policy for that kind of behavior.
So we have Kirsten Anderson saying she was fired. This was retaliation for her submitting complaints. We have Senator Bill Dix saying, no, this is a work, ethic case. And then we have this week, Governor Kim Reynolds says she backs Bill Dix in the case and his conducting of the investigation, and she has faith that sexual harassment will not be tolerated in the Iowa Senate. So do we know, what steps are being taken to prevent future harassment?
Well, so there's a few different things that have kind of happened on a few fronts since the jury handed down its $2.2 million verdict in favor of Kirsten Anderson last month. Now, Secretary of the Senate Charlie Smithson, who's the nonpartisan employee responsible for overseeing the administration of the Iowa Senate, has started an investigation into sexual harassment to sort of get to the bottom of some of the claims that were made throughout the lawsuit and determine if there might still be any ongoing issues at the Senate. Now, Anderson's attorneys have argued that there should be an independent third-party investigation that human resources professionals and employment lawyers should be contracted to conduct an independent investigation to determine whether current workers fear retaliation and whether there's any ongoing problems.
So non-Senate staffers, basically.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Concerns that what would be best is for an independent third party who is not employed by the state to go in and conduct that investigation.
And finally, you know, attorneys for the state are asking for a new trial, this new news yesterday. Is there any indication this request will be granted?
Well, it will really be up to a judge. The attorneys have laid out in their brief concerns that they have about how the closing argument from Anderson's attorney was conducted, concerns that his comments might have prejudiced the jury. So that will really all be decided at a hearing to be scheduled, but it's hard to know exactly what the outcome of that will be.
All right. Des Moines Register court reporter Grant Rogers. You can follow him on Twitter at Grant M. Rogers, and you can follow his reporting at thedesmoinesregister.com. Grant, thanks for talking with me.
Hey, thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Tuition increases have been steady and significant at Iowa State universities over the last few years. Yesterday at a Board of Regents meeting, there was a task force convened to discuss what to do about the trend of rising tuition. The task force is made up of four regents who will report to the full board at its September meeting. The Iowa City Press Citizen's education reporter, Jeff Carice-Carlson, covered the meeting, and he joins me in the studio now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So you reported that tuition increases have more than made up for cuts in state funding at two of Iowa's public research universities, ISU and the University of Iowa. Can you put that into some context? How significant have these cuts been and then the tuition increases to follow?
Well, in terms of cuts to the universities, they've been hit with kind of a double whammy this year. There was the mid-year cuts that the Iowa legislature put forward earlier in the year that wound up being about $20.75 million across the three universities. Then on top of that, when their new budgets came out, they saw another million or $9 million plus on that. So it's a little bit more than $30 million total less that they have at the beginning of this year than they were expecting at the start of last year. So for those $30 million, the increases in tuition that we've seen from last year to this year have made up for that money. But the universities, well, they've made up for the money at Iowa and Iowa State. There's about $500,000 less at the University of Northern Iowa. But the university presidents are pretty clear that that barely covers an increase in inflation or other costs, and it definitely doesn't allow them to do many of the programs that they think they need to do to add more faculty for what's basically their growing student bodies.
Mm-hmm. And I saw, ISU's interim president, Ben Allen, and the University of Iowa's president, Bruce Harreld, were both at the meeting.
Well, it was a telephonic meeting.
So
they literally called in.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, you know, Ben Allen saying students have been asked to pay more tuition, faculty staff's not receiving any salary increase. You know, it just seems that lately, you know, everyone's doing more with less. And as far as tuition goes, that there's no end in sight for this issue.
Well, what happens was, in terms of the tuition task force, the regents actually called for that a few months ago. It was right after they received the word about not only having the mid-year cuts, but even lower money. In the past, they've tried to bargain with the legislature, saying, we will either freeze tuition or hold a really low increase on tuition if you give us a little bit more money than you've given us last year. This year is the first year in a while that they've seen a major decrease in the amount of money they've gotten from the state. So as a result, they're trying to convene a task force to say, what are we going to do about this? We can't just wait until the end of the legislature to be able to know what we're going to get for next year, because otherwise we're going to have to, like we did this year, like we did last year, have to increase tuition at the last minute before the school year. That's not good for Iowa students or their families. It's not good for the universities to know what to expect. So that's what they're starting, and that's the types of questions that they're asking.
Can you give an idea of, for someone who isn't paying tuition mm-hmm. right now, you know, when on an individual student basis for in-state and out-of-state, how much are students paying? What does this tuition increase actually come out to for an individual student?
For the individual students, it winds up being the tuition is somewhere around $7,000 at the three universities. Then there's usually an assortment of mandatory fees that push it up closer to $9,000.
Per year?
Per year. The amount for out-of-state students is quite a bit more at all three universities, but it's a little bit different. And forgive me, I didn't double-check the numbers right before I came. It's about $20,000 more at the University of Iowa. It's a little bit less than that at Iowa State, and it's about $10,000 more at the University of Northern Iowa. So every time that they talk about a 3% increase, that increase, that gap widens, that every time that they look about percentage-wise, it's simply because in-state students are paying less than out-of-state students.
Mm-hmm. This tuition task force, are they getting a lot of public input? Did you hear from Iowans about this?
So the tuition task force officially was supposed to kick off last month with a day-long meeting in Des Moines where they talked to legislative people and governmental people in the morning, and then business people in the afternoon, and for some reason they couldn't get enough people to agree to participate in that discussion. So they wound up canceling that first meeting, which was supposed to be kind of the introductory, set the stage, get everything out on the table kind of meeting. Instead, their task force now is just going to meet at the three universities. There's one on Monday at the University of Northern Iowa, then next Wednesday at Iowa State University, and then Monday the 14th at Iowa, at the University of Iowa. And what those are going to be is from about 10:30 to 11:30 or so, the universities are going to present their five-year strategy for tuition. And I'm guessing that it's not going to go down, that those five-year strategies are basically going to be looking at how are we going to raise tuition, what are the different ways we're going to set it, are we going to set it for different programs at different levels, are we going to charge more for juniors and seniors than we do for freshmen and sophomore, how are some of the ways that we're going to answer this. So each university will present that for an hour, and then there'll be about an hour of community comment afterwards.
So it's more of, you know, dealing with the issue rather than eliminating the issue of high tuition.
It's more of dealing. Yes, it's more and answering the question, well, what are we going to do? It seems unlikely that the legislature is going to come up with the additional money to even make the universities whole based on what they've lost over the last year. So they have to figure out some other way to raise the money.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the task force meetings coming up. For those interested in attending or viewing the live stream of those meetings, you can find them at iowaregents.edu, or you can Google Iowa Regents Tuition Task Force. Jeff Grace Carlson, education reporter with the Iowa City Press Citizen, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Two big political events are happening in Iowa soon. The revival of what was formerly known as the Harkins Steak Fry, an event hosted for decades that ended with Senator Tom Harkin's retirement in 2014. And the other event is happening this weekend, Bruce Rastetter's Ag Summit, where USDA Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue will be speaking. To preview these events and their significance is our go-to political analyst, Rachel Caulfield. She's an associate professor at Drake University. Hi, Rachel. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Emily. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks. And so let's talk a little bit about the Ag Summit in Des Moines tomorrow. This is going to be hosted at Hy-Vee Hall at the Iowa Events Center. You know, is this an opportunity to kind of introduce the concerns and goals of Midwestern Ag to a secretary whose experience as governor of Georgia dealt mostly with Southern ag interests?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the Ag Summit, which is a relatively new event, and kind of got its big kickoff right before our last caucus season. This is designed to really highlight Iowa's agricultural issues and bring them into not just a statewide spotlight, but a national spotlight. And so for this particular event, I think we should expect to see, a really engaged conversation. And as you said, an opportunity for Sunny Perdue to be familiarized with what's going on across the rural Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the political makeup of this event. It's pretty new, and the summit's hosted by Bruce Rassiter, a well-known Republican donor. We have Sunny Perdue joining, and also U.S. Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley and Governor Kim Reynolds. Seems to represent conservative interests pretty well.
Yep.
Are there going to be some, Democrats at the event as well?
Oh, undoubtedly there will be some Democrats, but, I think this is really viewed as an opportunity for conservative voices to come together around agricultural interests in the state.
Mm-hmm. The Ag Secretary announced Monday he would visit China to mark the return of U.S. beef to the country. And Iowa Ag Secretary Bill Northey was in China earlier this month as part of Iowa's trade delegation. What discussions can we expect on trade here?
Well, obviously, this is the hot button issue right now in agriculture. And it's not a huge surprise that China is a focus. First of all, because China is a huge trading partner. But of course, second of all, because Iowa has a great connection to China through Governor Branstad, former Governor Branstad. There's this kind of window of opportunity to really highlight the opportunities for Iowa agricultural interest to be trading actively with China. So I think we can expect that to be a major piece of the conversation tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Now, last year, Bruce Rastetter hosted one-on-one conversations with presidential hopefuls. And, we're kind of questioning whether he's a kingmaker here in Iowa or, also nationally. And this year, it's kind of more of a panel discussion. How is that going to be different?
Well, this always happens with Iowa political events. The year before a presidential caucus season, we see kind of the cattle call events where all the would-be presidents come through and have an opportunity to meet with Iowa activists, in an open forum where Iowans have a chance to hear their views. But then other years, they might take different formats. In that respect, I think this is consistent with what we've seen in the past. Having said that, there is always an aspect of these events where people start raising their eyebrows and saying, huh, you're coming out to Iowa. I wonder what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you have presidential ambitions, this is a great opportunity to get out to the state early and start meeting the activists.
Hmm. Are you going to be headed over there tomorrow?
I am not going to be because I have to be in Algona tomorrow.
All right. Well, what are you going to be looking for to come out of it?
Well, I think we're going to be, kind of keeping an eye on, first of all, who's there, in addition, of course, to Sunny Perdue, but what other names are coming up and starting to be a part of this conversation. But I think we're also looking for, the degree to which the conversation is centered on broader agricultural issues, because that's really going to define the issue agenda going forward. So what issues are coming up consistently? How can we expect that issue agenda to change?
Mm-hmm. Again, the Iowa Ag Summit being hosted tomorrow in Des Moines at Hy-Vee Hall, talking with Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Let's talk a little bit about what was known as the Harkin steak fry. They're bringing
back
the steak fry this year. Is that surprising to you?
Well, it's surprising that, it's surprising only in the sense that I think there was widespread anticipation that something would come to replace the steak fry. The idea that the steak fry has such longevity in the state of Iowa that they're bringing back the steak fry. They're sticking with the original here.
So I've been hearing that, the speakers this year, U.S. Representatives Sherry Bustos, Seth Moulton, and Tim Ryan, they're going to be focusing more on economic issues and jobs versus kind of, social issues, identity politics. Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's internally within the Democratic Party, I think there's a very vibrant conversation going on right now, assessing what happened in 2016, how to better appeal to quote unquote middle America. those states that they really expected to do well in and didn't. And these three U.S. representatives are kind of a wing of the party right now that are saying, hey, you know, we need to stop talking about all this other stuff. We need to focus in on what our economic message is and really highlight those issues.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but Ryan and Moulton have expressed criticism of the House Minority Leader,
yes,
Nancy Pelosi. I think yep. Representative Ryan even challenged her for the leadership post.
He did
last
indeed,
year.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So are we going to see these three take on a little bit more leadership within the party? Is this a signal of that?
I think it's pretty clearly an effort to elevate their stature within the party. You know, also important, of course, that Sherry Bustos and Tim Ryan are from Midwestern districts and districts where Donald Trump did exceptionally well. And so kind of the idea is, how can Democrats be talking to these districts, to these voters more effectively? And, you know, in many ways, it's parallel to, for example, the New Democrats movement that was led by Bill Clinton once upon a time before he became president. But that position with the New Democrats really elevated Bill Clinton within the party. And I think we see three relative newcomers to the U.S. Congress who see a similar opportunity to elevate their position within the party.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the revival of the steak fries kind of a sign that, you know, Iowa continues to remain relevant and important when it comes to national politics? And other, you know, every year we kind of question, you know, Iowa first. Is that still going to be the case 5-10 years from now? Is this a good sign for Iowa?
I think it is. You know, the number one thing that has to happen in order to maintain a really vibrant political environment, I think, is that you have to have regular gatherings of activists to have these sorts of conversations about where the party is going, what issues are going to be front and center going forward. And Joni Ernst started the Roast and Ride, and the Ag Summit exists. And, you know, there was really kind of a vacuum on the Democratic side. Where were these conversations among activists going to happen? They had happened at the steak fry for so long that I think this is a signal that the party's in a period of rebuilding, and this is a piece of that. I would say I think there's one issue that they may have to contend with, and that is, you know, the steak fry was Tom Harkin's event. It was a statewide event in Indianola. Moving it to Des Moines Waterworks Park and having it sponsored by the Polk County Democrats changes its meaning a little bit.
Mm. All right. Well, that's coming up September 30th, the steak fry. Rachel Caulfield, political scientist at Drake University. Rachel, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to River on Iowa Public Radio. We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned. Iowa Public Radio's Dennis Reese will be delivering some fresh Iowa news here in a minute, and we'll be back to some conversations after that. That and more in a few minutes here on River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on this Friday edition of River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. This week, the ACLU of Iowa announced they will be honoring two Iowa women for their civil rights work over the years with the Edward S. Allen Award. Former Lieutenant Governor Joy Corning, who passed away earlier this summer, is one recipient. The other is Mary Campos from Des Moines. Mary was the first Latina woman to serve on the Iowa Civil Rights Commission and to be inducted in the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame. She's been involved in the League for United Latin American Citizens and other boards and councils as an advocate for civil rights and equality. She and ACLU board member Joe Henry join me now. Hi, Mary. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Hello.
Mary, congratulations on this award, and thank you for your contributions to Iowa over the years.
Thank you very much.
So, Joe, start us off. Tell me a little bit about the Edward S. Allen Award and what it recognizes.
Yeah, this is the Founder Award. Very few people ever receive this award. This is given out to those who have been fighters for civil rights throughout Iowa's history. So Mary is one of, I think, about a dozen people who've been the recipient of this award. So we really are looking forward to giving this award to Mary in September.
Mm-hmm. And what did you see in Mary that put her in the running for this recognition?
Mary has always been a fighter for civil rights. In 1947, she went to work for Dr. Stan Griffin, whose wife was Edna Griffin. Edna Griffin fought for civil rights. She demanded to be seated in the white-only section of Katz Drugstore in 1947. So Mary was with the family for many years, over two decades, and during that time, she also ran for city council here in Des Moines to fight for equality. And she also fought for equality in the Des Moines Police Department. Back in the 1980s, when the city of Des Moines was not acknowledging the right of Latinos to work as police officers. And then Mary has continued on to fight for civil rights. She's been with us within LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, doing voter registration, voter education, helping young Latinos to become leaders. She's even housed many of our young Latinos here in Des Moines. So she's always been with us. She helped us fight voter suppression back in 2012 when the ACLU was working with LULAC to fight that when Matt Schultz was attempting to suppress the vote. So we applaud Mary for all her work over many, many decades. She's truly an inspiration not only to the overall community, but to especially us within the Latino community.
Mm-hmm. And Mary, let's go back to the start. I believe you're the granddaughter of coal miners from Mexico who came to Iowa for work. You know, how did your family background influence your work in Iowa over the years?
Well, my father and his mother and father, who were the ones from Mexico, but my father was born in Texas and my mother was born in Oklahoma. And so they were in McAlester, Oklahoma. And at that time in 1929, there was a tremendous mining explosion. And so this workforce was composed of Asians, Latin Americans, and African Americans and Italians that worked in the coal mine. It's my understanding that that really destroyed the economy of that town. And so they had to find other places to go to work. Some went to work in the cotton fields, and then my parents were involved in a work search by the CNH Sugar, and they came there and they gathered people together, and my dad was kind of active in that, and they got groups of people. And before my mother passed, I asked her, how did we come from Oklahoma to Iowa? And she said to me, of course, I was very young, and she said, we came on boxcars. They loaded us in the boxcars and took us to northern Iowa to work. So that's how we became immigrant workers, you know. And then we had to stop in Des Moines on the way back one year, and my dad was sick, and we ended up being in Des Moines. And I was about 6 or 7 years old when we started being residents of Des Moines.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad had an emergency operation. He couldn't work, and they had just come in from a field. And, they were going to go back to Oklahoma, but we never went back to Oklahoma. We stayed in Iowa.
Well, Joe mentioned, you know, that you became involved in Iowa in fighting for equality and for the hiring of, you know, Latino police officers and firefighters. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we saw a need for our young men to be able to progress and serve their community. And we had no Hispanic or Latino representation on the force. So we had a couple of young men that were very interested in that. And we worked together and helped them to get into one of our most hardworking, I would think, and although I don't want to shun anybody else, Joe Gonzalez made a career for himself. And he was from Mexico, and he was a young boy when he came here, and he worked hard. He graduated, and he was in the cadet program.
And so and Vince Valdez was the specific person that we were fighting for back in 1983.
Yeah.
We were actually, LULAC was picketing outside of City Hall, demanding that Vince be hired because there were certain regulations that were in place at that time that were very discriminatory towards Latinos in the 1980s.
Wow. Well, we only have about a minute left, but Mary, I want to ask you, you know, you've also mentored young Latinos over the years and helped families learn English and gain citizenship.
Yes.
What's your advice for people working in this field today?
In the what?
Just in this field, in, you know, the field of helping immigrants, you know, come to Iowa, to the U.S.
I think that we have become a welcoming state and we need to stay that way. And when we help one, we help the other. And they have a lot to offer to this country. And they've become educated, and they're good, professional, hardworking people.
All right. Well, ACLU board member Joe Henry and Mary Campos, recipient of the Edward S. Allen Award, thank you both for coming in today. And Mary, congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. You may remember a tragic story from last summer of an Eastern Iowa veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder and mental health issues who killed himself a day after being denied admission to the VA's inpatient psychiatric unit. This week, federal inspectors have announced that the suicide was not directly the fault of the staff of the Iowa City VA hospital. Des Moines Register health reporter Tony Lays has been covering this story, and he's on the line now. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Emily.
So tell me about this case. Remind us what happened to the late veteran Brandon Ketchum last year in his attempt to receive help.
Well, Ketchum had sought care and had gotten care from the VA off and on for several years. He had deployed twice to Iraq with the Marines and once to Afghanistan with the Iowa National Guard. And he'd been diagnosed with, among other things, PTSD, and he also had addiction issues, which stemmed for several years back before he even joined the military. And he had been going through a crisis, and he showed up at the Iowa City VA for an appointment with a psychiatrist, and he asked the psychiatrist to admit him as an inpatient. The psychiatrist said he didn't think he needed inpatient treatment and the inpatient unit was full that day, but that he thought he could be handled as an outpatient. And Ketchum got angry and stalked out of the appointment and the next day committed suicide.
And the report from the VA's Office of the Inspector General says they were looking into this case and whether it was an isolated incident. Is it?
Well, what the report found was they said they found shortcomings, especially in a couple of ways that the VA keeps track of mental health patients. But they also said that they didn't see that that directly led to this tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what they did say as far as what the psychiatrist did, that they said the psychiatrist's decision not to admit the patient was within acceptable practice based on the information available to him at the time. Was that ruling.
Mm-hmm. The VA appears to be, you know, very aware of the problem of the high level of veteran suicides, and they estimate
right.
that on average around 20 veterans commit suicide every day in the U.S. Have we seen them work towards addressing that problem?
There's been a lot of work toward addressing it. There hasn't been a lot of success. It's a very difficult, complicated, stubborn issue. So everybody is frustrated and saddened by it, but so far, they haven't been able to do a whole lot to bring that down.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Senators Grassley and Ernst, they've been saying there needs to be independent watchdogs to point out problems at the VA. Are there these independent watchdogs?
Well, the Office of Inspector General is fairly independent, and it looks like they did a pretty in-depth investigation here. That doesn't mean you have to agree with the conclusions. But I have seen at times the same office be pretty critical of the VA.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it was a very complicated, tough case.
Yeah. What else did these federal inspectors find?
Well, among the things they said could be improved were keeping track of patients who no-showed for mental health appointments, which Ketchum sometimes did, doing a better job of following up and trying to find out what happened and what's going on with that person. They're saying that could be improved. They're also saying that the internal communications on cases could be better because a lot of veterans see several different providers, and they're basically saying that the communication on those cases could be improved. And they base that on what they saw in the record here.
Mm-hmm. And the Iowa. Go ahead.
But again, they're saying they're being pretty clear that they don't see that even if that had been done in this case, that his suicide could have been prevented.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Iowa City Veterans, the VA, it's saying it's going to rewrite some of its policies. Do you have any idea, you know, what they might be doing? Where they go from here?
I don't know specifically, to be honest with you. And it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. It's always tough to write a policy for every possible situation.
Mm-hmm. No, I know Brandon Ketchum's family was sharply critical of the VA after his death.
They were.
Were you able to talk with them this week?
I spoke briefly to his mother yesterday evening. She said that she just hadn't read the full report and just was not ready to talk about it. So I don't know how they feel about this report yet. If they have something to say about it, I certainly would report their feelings on it. They were very disappointed at the time in how Brandon was treated by the VA.
All right. Well, Des Moines Register health reporter Tony Lay is following this story. You can follow his reporting at thedesmoinesregister.com and on Twitter at Tony Lay's. That's Lay's, L-E-Y-S. Tony, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
And I want to note one resource that hopes to help reduce the number of suicides. If you are having trouble or if someone you know is struggling, the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255 and then press 1. Again, that number, 800-273-8255. Since 2007, the staff report is answering, they've answered over 2.5 million calls. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. With 8035 and 515 Alive in Des Moines, the Hinterland Music Festival in St. Charles, Mission Creek and Witching Hour in Iowa City, and several more, Iowa has a lot to offer when it comes to music festivals. With me now to preview a new event happening August 18th and 19th in Lone Tree, Iowa, is the founder of Flat Black Studios, Luke Tweedy. Thanks for coming in to talk with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this event is called Gray Area. It's co-sponsored by your studio and a clothing store in Iowa City, White Rabbit. We were actually just listening to one of the bands that's going to be playing. What were we just hearing?
That was a track off of a record that just came out by a guy by the name of Charlie. That band is called Good Morning Midnight, and they will be playing on Saturday at the event.
Yeah, and this event, it's going to feature several genres of musicians, even circus performers, and there's going to be camping. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration for Gray Area.
Years ago, so when you mentioned White Rabbit is a clothing store that my wife runs. We own it together. And so we had always talked about doing an event like this, but never had the venue for it. Finally, a couple years ago, we moved out into the country and had been talking about it, but needed to build up a little bit of infrastructure to make it happen. Finally got there. We built a pretty nice stage out there and have made some camping areas and assembled a lineup and decided to go for it this year.
Yeah, so this festival is actually taking place in Lone Tree at your recording studio. Tell me a little bit about the venue.
So the property is about 10 acres. It's right in between Lone Tree and Hills, Iowa, just south of Iowa City. It's wooded land. It's behind the studio. We built a stage. It's 704 square foot. It's probably the most overbuilt stage or deck in Johnson County that's made out of wood. We decided to just, it would be a perfect venue to put these artists and acts, especially because people are used to seeing music in bars or seeing music in theaters, but not used to seeing music out in the woods in rural Iowa.
Yeah, I saw on your website, Flat Black Studios, you actually mentioned, or actually it was on Google, it was mentioned as a rural recording resort. Is that
sure.
Your wording or Google's?
No, that's my wording. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek because in the fact that it's rural puts us, you know, we are out in the country and it is in a repurposed barn. So resort's a pretty big stretch.
Mm-hmm. But it has a certain atmosphere.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, there seem to be more and more festivals in Iowa cropping up where there's camping involved, where there's things like, in this case, circus performance, where it's more than just going to see a musician. It's kind of, you know, an all-encompassing event. You know, you're a bunch of local food, local vendors will be there. Is this kind of a new phenomenon, a new type of festival? Is this specific to Iowa?
I can't say if it's a new type of festival for me. I just wanted it to be the type of festival that I would want to go to. I want to strengthen the Iowa music community the best that I can. I'm hoping that the punk kids will watch the Americana kids play. People that watch folk music will watch the rock bands, and so on and so forth. But the ability to add extra things like aerial performances by Elevate Vertical Fitness and the National Dance Academy, the ability to have people who help put on shows like Chris Wersema from Mission Creek and Witching Hour doing DJ sets, or even people that I might have normally asked to perform but want to perform in a different fashion, like William Elliott Whitmore doing a DJ set. I'm just trying to throw the event that I would want to go to.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the acts you're most looking forward to?
Honestly, I like every act on this bill. As I mentioned before, it is every type of music. I do have things kind of clumped together. After dark, it starts to get louder and gets really loud around midnight. But like Saturday morning and afternoon, there's going to be, you know, Dana T., Elizabeth Moen, Anthony Warden, Brian Johansson, Paul Carey, Jenny Hoyston. There's just some really fantastic people that everybody can enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought some tracks to our studio today, some of the musicians that are going to be playing. Can we hear one of them? What do you have up next?
You started with Good Morning Midnight, which I think that is a great track, especially because that kid is a teenager. When he started recording the album, he was 18 years old, and it's really something special. I think it would be appropriate for you guys to go out with Liz Moen because she's really getting quite a lot of attention. She's really, really working hard on her stuff. But the act that's traveling the farthest to this festival is Jenny Hoyston. She's coming all the way from Austin, Texas. She's made a couple records with me, Erasurata, Paradise Island. She's toured with Sonic Youth, The Slits, and she's coming all the way to Iowa to play this. So,
all right, Jenny Hoyston, what track is this?
This is going to be on her new record. We're working on it right now.
Jenny Hoyston out of Texas.
Yeah, she is so fantastic. She's played Mission Creek before. She's played Iowa City, like I said, with her main act, Erasurata, and with Paradise Island, and she's coming up to play this fest. It's pretty great.
Anyone else you want to highlight?
I think people should just come and see for themselves. There's so many bands, so many acts playing. Yeah, it'd be great to see you all out there.
All right, and I have to ask, since people will be Googling this, Gray Area is actually spelled G-R-E-Y, which is kind of the British spelling.
The British spelling.
Gray.
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
Because I found there's another Gray Area festival in San Francisco spelled the other way.
Well, this is the Iowa one,
yep,
Gray, that, G-R-E-Y.
That's correct.
I've been talking with Luke Tweedy. He's the founder of Flat Black Studios. This festival is going to be August 18th and 19th in Lone Tree, Iowa, Gray Area. More information and access to tickets can be found at littlevillagetickets.com. Luke, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
And I will mention that proceeds for the Gray Area event will be going to the ACLU of Iowa and the Rape Victims Advocacy Program in Iowa City.
Take yours, I'll take it all mine. Worth the while.
Elizabeth Moen with her track Tell Me When. She'll be at the Gray Area Festival. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Emily Woodbury. Production River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Have a great weekend.